Welcome to the Life Insurance Financial Education Podcast. We're pulling back the curtain on high cash value life insurance, revealing its role in a comprehensive financial strategy to help you build wealth and achieve your financial goals. I'm your host, James Barber with Oregon Cash Flow Pro.
This is Jing with Tech's Exempt Millionaire Club.
And I'm Carlo with NetWealth Finance.
Welcome, everybody. Today, we're going to be talking about IUL. We talked about last week whole life. We're a big fan of whole life. We're also big fans of IUL and where it fits in somebody's overall portfolio. So we're going to be talking today about IUL, the different things about it, the products themselves, how we design them, and anything else we can think about that might bring you value when it comes to the IUL. So stick around. Before we jump into the IUL, do you have any updates in regard to anything going on in your personal lives, investments, your life insurance policies?
I have a rental property which is not performing. So I'm thinking about doing some development project, but it could be a big, big hassle. That property has 10 acres of land. I'm trying to figure out if I can convert that. I need to do the zoning and then convert that into a mobile home park. But since there's a new build and development, I'm sure I'm going to get a lot of setbacks. So it's going to be, I don't know if it's going to eventually be a real development project or I can just sell it because it's not performing.
How's the mobile home park going?
It was much better. We capped about 20 to 25% of the people we inherited from the previous seller. And then we renovated. Right now I'm renovating the 13th and 14th trailer. And then we're gonna renovate the 15th. After this two will be done. And we swapped a lot of tenants. So it will eventually get to that point, which I feel very comfortable to leave it to someone. Right now, I'm still managing it remotely, and I go there almost every month.
How many mobile homes in your park?
The park itself has 25 pets. Right now, we have 21, which livable. Like, it's people are renting and living inside. Outside, there's a couple of single families, and there's also about 8-9 mobile homes outside. Those are mobile home on land. So it's a little different than a mobile home park, but most of the valuable asset in the entire portfolio will be this mobile home park.
And do you own the mobile homes themselves or just most of them or all of them?
Most of them. When we bought the portfolio, there's only 2 out of the 34 units. The 2 of them are tenant owned. Gotcha. That's why we keep renovating. We keep changing tenants, try to remove the bad ones, throw them out, and put the right people into the park, and really provide the middle class a stable, affordable place to live. And then we try to also do the lease with option to buy, so they will eventually be the owner as long as they pay the rent, they take care of the home, they obey all the park rules. Eventually, that will be their asset. The mobile home, we still own the land, of course. Sure. That's the entire model of the mobile home park investing.
Nice. Well, thanks for sharing. I think it's valuable to our viewers to understand a little bit of the background, what we're working on, because maybe they have an interest in high cash value life insurance, but they also want to talk to one of us that's doing something in the area that they would like to expand their investing to, or maybe it's some area they're already investing in. And then feel free to reach out to Jing if you got any questions about that or if you think there's a way that she can help. Carlo, you got anything going on?
Yes, my boat finally made it down to the BVI a few days ago, so that's a bit of a relief. It's still, we're working to make sure that it's ready to go for its first charter in about a week. Good progress that it actually made it down there safely. So
just the first charter for this season, right?
Yes, the first charter for this season.
Well, good luck. I think we've talked in previous episodes about some of the challenges around lightning storms that you've had with that thing. So it's had its challenges. Overall, what's been your experience with that ownership, getting it rented out?
Having two lightning strikes on the same vessel certainly is a lot. That doesn't make it a great experience. So lessons learned, and I'll say that generally life insurance has been very helpful for me to help bridge some of the things as I'm moving assets around in order to kind of cover these costs. The life insurance has been super helpful in being able to borrow against my policies and fund the different things that are necessary. So overall, so far, hasn't been great, but for me, sailing is part of my dream. So I'm all about having this mixture of the lifestyle business and being able to deduct vacations in a sense. When if you go do some maintenance on the vessel and check things out, having the ability to deduct what could be mixed with vacation. So a mixed use working vacation is kind of part of the idea behind this. And then also I want to sail. I like sailing. It's something that I really enjoy.
I imagine one of the big benefits of having had equity built up in your life insurance policies that you can tap into when you had an emergency. Lightning does strike twice, apparently. When you had an emergency that cost you tens of thousands of dollars, that you could tap into a loan. Now, the boat would be out of commission, right? If you weren't able to do that. If you didn't have the cash set aside or you didn't have money in your life insurance, you would have had to go to a bank for a loan or tap into some other line of credit that would require you to make monthly payments on that. So you would take a loan and then you would have to be making payments, but the boat might not be generating any income yet. So the unique structure that you utilize, where you borrow from your life insurance, there's no payments. You don't have to make a payment, and it gives you this runway that, at the very least, you just cover the interest if you need to, but it's not required. And it allows you to get the boat back in service and get it working and making more money. And then when it starts to make money, it's going to pay the loan back, right?
Absolutely. It's basically unmatched. What we have in the ability to borrow against these policy loans and have borrow against our policies, there's not really anything that's like it. As you said, you don't actually have any kind of payment terms. It's effectually treated like an interest-only loan if you want to. And if you don't pay the interest on it, it just adds to the principal at the policy anniversary. So you can just kind of let it as you need to in an emergency situation go for a while. And for me, yes, exactly. When the boat starts generating revenue, I'll pay it off, or as I move, I'm probably going to sell one of my properties to just so that I don't have outstanding loan balances. It's a property that I'm probably not going to do something with anyway. So, but in the meantime, I'm not doing a HELOC. I'm not doing, I mean, I might end up doing a HELOC for other purposes, but I don't have to do a HELOC. I don't have to sell other things in my brokerage or other types of things. The life insurance is just a flexible thing that I can borrow against in this sort of emergency situation of lightning striking twice.
Nice. So I don't have much to update as far as mine. I've got a restaurant up in Washington. We own a building, and the bottom floor is a restaurant. And up above, we have some rental units. One of them is short-term rental. The other three are long-term rentals. Nothing new to report as far as that goes. I did want to mention, I like to trade in the stock market, I like to trade options in the stock market. And I like to think that I'm really knowledgeable when it comes to options and trading and stuff. But trading takes a lot of time, and you got to watch the market. You got to spend some time watching the market. And I haven't had a whole lot of time to do that. So I'm not going to give any investment advice here because we're not licensed to give stock market investment advice, but I like to share what we're doing. So don't take this as specific financial advice for you. Just consider everything that we talk about here as financial advice that, in the sense of, this is what we're doing. And if you're interested, you could look into it. You could always talk to us if you want to. But one of the things that I've done is because I'm not taking the time to sit in front of the computer and do the day trading like I like to do with options. Instead, I've outsourced my options trading. Now, I say that because what I did is I ended up putting a bunch of money into an ETF that is an income ETF that makes income by selling options daily. And QDTE happens to be one of them that I've been really happy with. This ETF hasn't been out for very long, but the annual return for dividends, because it pays out every single week, the annual return is somewhere around 24%.
Wow.
And they do that by selling 0 day to expiration options. So every single day, they're trying to make some income, and that gets shared via that dividend, and they pay it out weekly. It's been really good, and it's been holding its value, and it's been paying out. It's actually been going up in value and paying out at that dividend rate. So really good. Now the market's been good. The market's been, I guess over the last 2 months, it's been kind of up, kind of sideways, a little bit up and down, but I've been really happy with what I've been seeing in this. So anyways, I just thought I would share that.
So it sounds to me like that one's likely an ordinary income sort of dividend, right? There's no tax
Correct,
efficiency to
correct. So
that.
I just trade and invest in my retirement accounts. Everything outside of my retirement accounts is basically in life insurance and real estate. So right now, the way it currently sits is I got tired of having a book of trades to report to the IRS when I'm trading in an after-tax brokerage account. So I decided to shift my trading into my retirement accounts where I don't have to do that. There's no reporting. So yes, so that is one thing to keep in mind with my particular situation is I'm doing that within a retirement account, so I don't have to worry about paying taxes each year on those dividends. If you're going to do that with an after-tax brokerage account, not as attractive, I don't think, because obviously you got to pay taxes on that and you still have the risk of loss and something to keep in mind. Good point.
Yeah, one thing very quick. So December 31st is the deadline if you want to do the Roth conversion. I know you have to pay every single dollar of the traditional IRA, the do dollar amount from traditional IRA to Roth IRA, but a lot of people are confused about the April 15th deadline versus December 31st.
Oh, good points. I always do mine at the beginning of the year. So,
So you're saying the Roth conversion is a dead, there's a deadline to do a conversion?
yeah, so what she's saying, you can contribute to a traditional IRA up until April 15th, but if you do a Roth conversion, you only have until the end of the year to do a conversion for that year.
Yes.
I appreciate the update, you guys, on your investments. Let's jump into what everybody is here for, which is the IUL. So in the IUL space, there are hundreds of products. A lot of different carriers out there offer an IUL. There's all kinds of different participation rates, cap rates. There's different ways that they can be structured. So knowing that there's basically hundreds of products, let's try to narrow it down a little bit. How many IUL products out there do you guys actually like? For what we do, which is a high cash value design.
I personally own Allianz IUL. And once I was out of New York State, when I was living in New York State, it is very hard to, you can still buy IUL, but because of the state mandate, there's a lot of whole life there. IUL, the option is minimum, such as I do believe Allianz, you won't be able to buy any IUL in the state of New York. So that's what I pick, and then I'm happy so far with the performance.
National Life seems like the best for if you're funding lower levels of funding, and Allianz is the best product overall. I think Securian can also be a great product. F&G can also be a great product. That's it for the most part. There's other circumstances, but I think those are the most, highly recommended, I would say.
There's a number of different products that we can do good designs with. I know on my YouTube channel, I analyzed all of the top IULs and I looked at what we can do for designs. And we're going to talk a little bit about designs in a bit. But one of the things that I look for when it comes to the high cash value designs that we do is, can I do a nice blended design that allows us to minimize the expenses and give that product the highest likelihood of success? And in my mind, there's basically like four or five different carriers out there that I would consider using right now. That doesn't mean some of the other carriers can't work okay, but I like to measure it in the likelihood of success. And there's certain carriers out there that don't allow us to reduce the expenses inside of it. And one of the biggest expenses is going to be the commissions that are going to get paid out and the amount of money the insurance company has to recoup. That money comes directly out of the client's pocket. And reduces the likelihood of success. I think one of the biggest things that I like to look at is, or one of the things that I've noticed is with the bad designs, what I consider the bad designs, which is the high expense designs upfront, where a client's putting in money and not seeing very much cash value in these. You get 1 or 2 years into these, they have big surrender charges, and so they're putting a bunch of their hard-earned money into these products, and they're not seeing any cash growth, and then maybe the market doesn't perform good. And then they're wondering, why did I get into this? Why am I owning this product? And so they fund it a little lower, or they don't fund it at all the next year. And that compounds the problems with a high expense design. And then the next thing you know, they're canceling the product because it hasn't made them any money, and they're wondering if it ever will. So those types of designs I view as not a high likelihood of success. Like I said, we'll get into the designs, but that's what I look for. So of the hundreds of products that are out there, there's really only a handful of products that I think are worthy of attempting to put a bunch of our money into it as a good alternative to whatever else we could do with putting our money into, right? Because there's always something else that we could be doing with our money. Why should we put it into here? So let's answer that question. Why would you say somebody should put their money into an IUL as opposed to something else, an investment in the stock market or real estate or even whole life?
I have sort of an example right now, and it's not necessarily going to be everybody's experience, but right now I have a loan against my policy. I'm paying 5% interest on it. I do have the opportunity to lock one of my indexing strategies at around 14%. So the arbitrage there, I'm earning 9% on borrowed funds. That is one of the main draws of an IUL. And those particular funds, well, I could sell a whole bunch of stuff in my brokerage account to pay off that loan if I wanted to. But I also earned this past year, I've left that money in the brokerage, or it's earning in a regular brokerage account at a higher rate as well. So that 9% is just added to my return on those funds. And that's one of the main reasons why I really like the IUL for me and my purposes.
So the good opportunity for arbitrage between the borrowed funds and the credit inside the policy, regardless of what you do with the funds, right? That could be even better. That could make it even better. But the opportunity to get arbitrage between the growth in the index options inside the IUL and the loaned funds.
Exactly. That's pretty much the main reason why I love my IUL. And I think that's one of the unique features or unique capabilities that to have that. I mean, 9% arbitrage is really good. And so I think that is a really big strength of IUL.
Now, that's not something you're going to get every year, of course. So
no.
What happens? How does it make you feel if you don't get arbitrage in a year? Because you might not get any credit if the market is down or sideways.
That's the risk that we run. And I think that if we're doing other things, and if we were going to borrow to do something anyways, then I'm paying what is a pretty good rate. 5% is not a bad rate anyway. So that's not, I mentioned my brokerage is that I could pay off the loan if I wanted to, but I'm also doing other things that I could do to pay off the loans. And it's just 5% is not a terrible rate to be paying, especially right now with rates where they're at. So worst case scenario, I'm paying 5%.
And some of these products have a guaranteed bonus inside of them too. So you might not even be paying 5% in a 0 year. Maybe you're only paying 4%.
Exactly.
Yeah, for me, there's, in addition to what Carlo just mentioned, there's two more. One is the tax benefit. Since in our household, we're always at the highest tax bracket, I want that bucket of money earning a tax free in its lifetime if you use it right. Of course, we are getting the loan out, we have to pay the 5%, but whatever the money inside that bucket, all the gains, is if you use it correctly, there's no tax consequences. Well, personal income tax is still subject to the inheritance tax. The other thing is, I'm looking at the, like what Carlo mentioned, compared to whole life, yes, the dividend is 5%, 7%, 6%, but that's the gross. When you look at your dollar amount, sometimes it's still less than that published dividend rate. So I want my money grows at a higher speed on top of the tax benefit. So overall, if I know what I'm doing, I will make sure, like what you mentioned, some of the people, they buy IUL, eventually they don't know how to structure, oh, it's a bad policy to begin with. And if they didn't found it correctly, eventually they surrender it, the policy lapse. That's really bad situation.
Where I like to position the IUL is generally, if somebody is perfectly fine, they've got investments in the stock market, but maybe they don't want to be 100% in the stock market, or they don't want all of their exposure in whatever their investments are to have downside potential. The IUL can be a good alternative. It can be a good place that we have good growth potential with that downside protection. That's like the ideal place for that. Now, whole life serves a purpose that's more along savings route. You're not going to get 20 or 15 or 30% return in any given year in a whole life, and that's fine. We're not necessarily trying to do that. We might be looking at, with our whole life, investing outside of that product in order to get those types of returns. Well, you're going to have some people that don't do other investments. And so what are their options if they're not savvy enough to go out and invest in real estate or crypto? Or maybe they don't even know how to do much in the stock market. And so like they might be in whatever that human resources department told them that they're invested in with the stock market and their retirement account. Like there's a lot of people like that that might just like to have a little bit less exposure to the stock market, but still have that growth potential within the product where it can get some really good returns in any given year. So that's the way I like to look at it. So that takes us to knowing that like we have some protections there. Let's talk a little bit about how these things work. How does the IUL itself work?
So the IUL is built on annual renewable term. So the costs of insurance are not fixed for the life of the policy in the same way that whole life is. So that is one thing that does two different things. There's cheaper costs up front. Because whole life is averaging out that cost of insurance over the life of the policy, if you're young and healthy, you can have much cheaper premiums or much cheaper cost of insurance on the early years of your policy. So that's one thing that's really powerful when trying to have cash value growth. And that is because of the fact that it is built on top of annual renewable term.
Another thing to add for IUL is it's index-based. Although your money, your cash value will not be in the market, it will be just reference the index, and you have different options based on the carrier's choice. But because of this feature, it's called Index Universal Life. Every carrier will give you different choices for the index, and you have the options to pick and then have some different allocations of those index you pay. Some of the index will also give you some bonus each year.
So let's dive into that just a little bit. The index options, there are volatility index options that different carriers have. We've got S&P index options, and basically there's probably dozens of different indexes that people can choose in any particular product, right? A particular product might have only a handful, but among the hundreds of products, you've got dozens of choices as far as index goes. How those work, the insurance company is going to have a budget each year, and they're going to offer you the option of getting whatever the fixed rate is. You can just say, you know what? I will take that flat rate for this year. I don't want to be invested in an index. Or you can take that budget and put it into your different allocated index options. So you get to choose. You want certain percentage in fixed or index A or B or C or D or any combination as long as it adds up to 100%. They're going to take that budget and whatever index options you choose, they're going to go buy call options on those indexes. That's essentially how these work. They're going to go buy call options. And if that call option is expensive, if it's more expensive than the budget, then you're going to have a cap. That means you're going to be limited on how much growth that you can get in any particular year. And if the options are less expensive, then you might have no cap, and we'll call those uncapped options. So there are a variety of capped and uncapped options. There's also another alternative where it might be uncapped, but you just get a lower than 100% participation rate. All of those are valid. None of those are good or bad. You have to look at what each one gives you the opportunity to earn with and choose accordingly. Now, hopefully your agent is knowledgeable enough that they can give you some good advice on which particular index options might be good. I generally like to go with some type of a set it and forget it type of diversified portfolio in there so that we're not constantly trying to chase whatever might work best for this year, because it is really hard to try to time the market. What do you guys say?
I agree. I think that especially with these uncapped options, they're great. And that's in my own IUL, that is what I currently use. I think additionally, one other lever that can be pulled on is a spread. I think that when those are implemented, I believe that's probably in a similar circumstance to more expensive options. But I think that generally speaking, having a few different index options and the opportunity to expose yourself to different indexes and strategies is certainly valuable.
Good point. So with the spread, that is an option in some cases. And how that works is if we have a more expensive option, normally what the insurance company does is they're going to buy a call option 1 year out at whatever the value is of the index today. Well, if that option is too expensive, it might be cheaper to buy a call option that is 5% above where we're at today, or 6 or 7 or 10. So wherever that is, that just created your spread. That option is not going to make money unless the index goes up more than that 5% or 6% or 7. And once it surpasses that, if it stays above that through your anniversary, you're going to get whatever the credit is above that. So that's how the spreads work.
Well, to me, I totally agree what James just mentioned. Just try to set it and forget it. Since if you really want to time the market, just go do the brokerage account. And then in the meantime, when you are reviewing this policy with your agent on an annual basis, hopefully your agent does that as what we try to do on an annual basis. If it's not a good year, you really have to know how you can conquer this mentally, right? It's not performing as what you want to be, but you need to look at what this policy can do for you for the whole entire asset allocation picture of your asset.
So I wanted to add something to that. The one thing to consider with an IUL, if the market has a bad year, oftentimes that can mean a really big negative year for the standard markets. However, since you have that floor of zero or maybe even a guaranteed return on some indexing strategies of maybe 1%, the following year can oftentimes be a recovery year. And so it can bounce back and you can have a really strong year after a weaker year. So that's just another thing to think about and keep in mind with these indexing strategies is you can have a pretty big bounce back following a bad year.
So contrast that with if you're actually invested in the stock market and the stock market loses 50%, it has to gain over 100% for you to start making money again. Whereas in the IUL, stock market loses 50%, you just hold flat. And when the market goes back up, those indexes go back up, you could be making money the very next year. We don't have to wait for it to recover all of those losses. I love that about the IUL.
Exactly.
One of the things a lot of the IUL haters out there love to point out is the risks inside of the IUL. The insurance company is just shifting the risk onto you, the consumer. The shady insurance company is doing this because you're not going to be smart enough. You're not going to be diligent enough to be able to handle this product, and you're going to end up canceling it, and they'll walk away with all of your money. Now, the alternative to that, or the solution to that, of course, is you should just go buy this whole life insurance policy that has all of these guarantees, and then we don't have to worry about that. Before I talk about the problems I have with that, tell me what you guys think about when you hear that.
When I first get into life insurance world, I was trained by New York Life, and they specifically will teach you how bad IUL is. They will do side-by-side comparison and just smash IUL, saying that's the worst product you could ever sell to your potential clients. I think it's about education, right? That's why we are doing this podcast. I think as a consumer, that's your money. That's your life. That's the beneficiary you want to protect. So you need to know and you need to learn. The IUL Yes, as Carlo mentioned, it's built on the ART, the annual renewable chassis. So your cost of insurance will be much, much higher, say 7 years old versus now 30 years old. But if you know what you're doing, if you're working with a good life insurance agent, you at that time, you should build up a good chunk of cash value already. The cost of insurance should be very low in compared to the cash value. So at that time, you are having this chunk of money tax-free, and then it keeps growing. And then with the index option, you just have a good amount of asset allocated to this IUL. You have to take the ride to get there. And knowing even you have a high cost of insurance at age 70, 80, but you will have a big chunk of money sitting there for you.
To expand on what she was explaining with the cost of insurance at those later years is the net amount at risk is a term that is used. So the difference between your cash value and the death benefit, that's effectively the amount of insurance you're paying for. And so in those later years, when if we built up, which we should have built up a lot of cash value leading up to that, we will have the minimal net amount at risk. And that reduces that cost of insurance. And that's really what gets us to not having too much risk in those later years. It's really not all that much insurance. But also, when we think about this, when you have this floor and the ability to have the kind of growth that you can have in an IUL, you're gonna have a lot of cash value growth. And over that time period, you'll build up a lot and you have the opportunity to build up a lot of cash value. So I think that's a real strength that, yes, there's some risk transfer when you compare it to whole life with some of those really high guarantees, but the opportunity for growth is very high. So some of that, in my mind, is worth it. I still have a whole life policy. I think that there's nothing wrong with that as well. It's just when we have both of these options, I think both can be great options. And I do think that we have ways, especially as we get to these maximum blends. I mean, I think we'll talk a bit more about policy design. That is one of the biggest ways that, especially if we're talking about a young and healthy person, you have pretty minimal costs that you can have when we design these properly to drastically reduce the risks that you have within that policy.
Yeah, and I would add that when they're talking about the big bad insurance company shifting its risk onto the client, other than how I would dispute the characterization of the insurance companies, it's true that there is risk shifted on to the client. And the reality is the greater the guarantees in any product out there, the greater the costs are going to be. So one of the reasons we have the ability to get really good growth inside of IULs is because of the increased risk that we take on as consumers. Now, we're not taking on risk of loss due to market returns, but we can take on the risk of a 0 year where we might not get a credit. We are taking on the risk that, or the I should say the client is taking on the risk that they can handle making the choices on the different index options. Some people can't. Some people just, it's not for them to see an up and down stock market. It's not for them. They may shift everything out of the indexes into the fixed account in a bad year. And then they miss out on some really good years because they got scared, got cold feet. Those are the types of people that would be better off buying whole life. The people that tend to do really good in the IUL are the people that are normally used to the ups and downs of the stock market, but recognize that we're not participating in the downs anymore. We're just participating in the ups. And we do a good job of buy and hold. We're not going to play around too much. Now, when we do an illustration in an IUL, I like to do illustrations around 6%. I think we could beat that. I am beating that in some of my IULs. Some of mine that are more newer, we haven't beat that yet. But for the most part, I expect that we'll be able to beat that. But one of the reasons why there is no guarantee is because of all the different choices you have. We don't know if the client is going to switch to the fixed account. We don't know if they're going to fund it the way that the illustration says that they're going to fund it. We don't know if they'll stick to that plan. We don't know if they'll encounter a financial emergency and need to reduce what they're putting into it. We don't know if they're going to hop from index to index option, choosing the worst option every single year, trying to guess at what's going to happen in the market the next year. So like those are real risks that people can encounter, which is why I say we usually try and do a nice set it and forget it policy so that people aren't accidentally just kind of screwing up and not getting the growth they would otherwise get because they're getting too into it. They're manipulating it too much.
I'll also add, some of these folks who talk about the IUL being the worst thing ever, they talk as if some of those levers that we talked about earlier, the caps, the spreads, the participation rates, they talk as if the insurance company is going to go ahead and start pulling on those just because they feel like it, because they want your policy to fail. And it's just totally not the case. That is not how they actually operate. There are certain conditions that would make them choose to pull on some of those levers that could impact the performance in your IUL. And it is not in an insurance company's best interest to unnecessarily pull on those levers. That would is bad for business, bad for reputation. So those things are not gonna just happen for no reason. And that is another thing to keep in mind when maybe you've seen some of that content out there talking about all of these downsides with these products.
I think it's all about the education and also the risk reward, as what James just mentioned. You take a little bit risk and then the reward can be huge down the road.
Good points. Now, we've made it to the point in this where we're ready to pull back that curtain on how these things actually work. What we're going to talk about next is going to be how we minimize the expenses in this. How do we do an optimized design inside of an IUL to give the client the best opportunity for success? And this is what really excites me, because a lot of the people that come to me that have been working with other agents or they get illustrations, they bring these to me and then I show them what we can do for designs. And it's simply amazing. It never ceases to blow their mind at how much we can actually save if we're trying to make the best product for the client and put the most money into their pocket. There's basically two things that we can do when we're trying to optimize a policy. Now, there's kind of other different designs and stuff, but there's two basic things that we can do. What are those two basic things? Carlo, give me one, and Gene, give me the other.
So one of the primary things that we can do is we blend in term insurance that is the non-commissionable term. And different carriers will have different ratios that you can do this with. And in my policy, we have the ability to do a 10-to-1 blend in that. And that is how you optimize that policy to minimize that commission on your policy and to maximize the amount of cash that you can put in to your policy.
That's right. And the other one, Jing?
The other one is we should pick the option B, which is the increasing death benefit. The death benefit will increase as your cash value increases.
Yeah, exactly. So the death benefit goes up dollar for dollar as the cash value grows with an increasing death benefit option. Now, the reason we choose that is because the MEC space, the amount of money that you can put in that the IRS will limit us to based on the death benefit, is triple or close to triple the amount of money you can put in with a level death benefit option. Now, I do need to point out this is when we use the guideline premium test when determining the MEC test. MEC stands for Modified Endowment Contract. That's the limits the IRS sets based on the amount of death benefit and then, of course, how the design works. So when we switch the two things we do to optimize the policy, we're going to use an increasing death benefit with the guideline premium test, and we're going to do a blended design. And we're going to blend in some non-commissionable term insurance. It's the cheapest term insurance that you can buy because it's not paying anybody a commission, but it adds to the MEC space the amount of money that we can put into a policy. As an example, you might have $1 million. I can't tell you how many times that I've met with a client that has $1 million policy. Now, it's $1 million because the agent that sold them that policy just thought $1 million sounds nice. There was no other reason that they picked that death benefit other than it sounds nice. Well, they also did a level death benefit and They didn't do any type of a blend. And so they've got this massive expense inside this policy. They're paying for a whole bunch of insurance for no particular reason. It's certainly not based on the amount of money they want to put into the policy. And that's the kind of policy that ends up disappointing the client. And then they cancel it or they stop funding it after a few short years, right? Do you guys experience that same thing?
Well, yes. I think when we're looking at that example, the amount that your minimum premium is, if that is an all base level death benefit, it's a giant number pretty much at any age. So the risk goes up drastically with that. And I think that one other thing that you'll see in that sort of policy is pretty long time to recoup, and where you might have zero access to cash value for the first couple of years. So that is when we design these policies with the blend and the increasing death benefit, we're looking at, you know, in a perfectly optimized policy, 80, 90, or even slightly higher than that percent of cash value for some folks in that first year. So that's really powerful.
Now, some of these bad designs, the expenses might be 30, 40, or 50% of the amount of cash value in the policy. Like the expenses each year are just so high in relation to the amount of money that gets put into those. The likelihood of success in those policies is drastically diminished.
Sometimes I do side-by-side comparison. When I first get into this field, people saying, oh, you can design so many different versions, even with the same age, same health rating, same funding. I couldn't believe it. Later on, the more I learn it, it's actually the best design versus the regular design can make drastic difference, especially the early stage funding. If for the optimized design, the cash value will grow so much versus a not well-designed policy.
And one of the things that I've noticed with the poorly designed policies, those tend to be sold based on target premium. Target premium inside of these products is a bit of a misnomer. When you want to hit a target, that's something you aim for, right? You aim for a target. And so if somebody says, I want to put $10,000 a year into a policy, well, you might think, and a normal agent might design a policy that sets that target premium at $10,000. Makes sense, right? The problem is target premium has almost nothing to do with how much money you're putting into the policy. Target premium is how the commissions are determined. That's not all that it means, but it's a key indicator on how much the insurance company is going to want to recoup. Agents will generally make 100% of target premium, sometimes more, for that first year's commission. So when we see these giant target premiums that are designed to match what somebody's putting into a policy, that means almost every dollar you put in that first year is just gonna go to pay back commissions. That doesn't tend to work out very good from an expense standpoint. What happens when we do our blended design?
When we do the blend, you will see oftentimes when you have an optimized design, you bring that target premium down to maybe 10% of what it might otherwise have been for the same amount of mech space. And that's huge in lowering those costs and really maximizing the individual's cash value. So it is a drastic reduction when we hit that optimized design. Now, not everybody's going to actually be able to fund at that level, and not everybody needs to hit that fully optimized for a given carrier because they have no intention of funding at that level. But that's how much we can reduce it if somebody does have a desire to max fund one of these policies.
I think it depends on the age and the health rating, right? For an optimized design, just to illustrate by numbers, you should see at least 85, 88, up to 95% of the cash value on year one. I think that's when I did my IUL, I do believe I'm close to 90%.
Yeah, the range can really vary depending on the age of the person and how much of a blend we can do. Essentially, there are some carriers that the maximum blend that we can do might be a 3-to-1 blend. In that scenario, our target premium is going to be 3 times lower in an optimized design or 4 times lower than in your normal regular design. That's a high expense design. Well, if we have a 9-to-1 blend, that target premium is going to be 9 times lower. If we have a 10-to-1 blend, our target premium is going to be 10 times lower. So as an example, using the 10-to-1 blended design, because I encounter this a lot, at $1 million death benefit, the mech limit on $1 million with an increasing death benefit, let's say someone in their 40s, they're probably going to be able to put in somewhere around $50,000, $55,000, $60,000 a year into that policy. If it's not a blended design, that target premium at $1 million is probably going to pay out between $14,000 and $28,000 per commission, depending on the carrier. In an optimized design, if we can do that 10-to-1 blend, that commission might only be $2,500 or $1,400 or $2,000. It's so much lower. And that directly translates into more money into the client's pocket. And the cash value in that year one, much, much higher. The minimum that they might have to contribute in a given year is so much lower. If the target premium ends up dropping down to be $2,000, the minimum amount that they might have to put in a given year might be $2,400 or $2,500. Well, if it was that high commission design and they're paying a $14,000 or $20,000 commission, that minimum premium is going to be $14,000 or $20,000. So you're talking a big, big difference between what's required for somebody to put in as opposed to how we like to look at it as how much can I put into this policy? When we have a really good design policy, the attitude, we don't treat this like an expense. Like, I get excited every time I get to pay my premiums each year because I get to put more money in. And almost all of it turns into cash value because the expenses are so low in the designs.
I think that that's exactly it. The terms that we think of this in and how I look at my policies and the people we work with, it is how much do you want to put in? And we design around that. It's not about what this target premium or the commissions or anything like that. How much does a person want to put in and how much can we minimize the costs to get that amount of cash in? There might be other considerations if they want to meet a death benefit need, but that's how we want to also think about things is initially, how much does the person want to put into the policy?
Now, there could be an argument in whole life that a design that pays out a higher commission might possibly be more beneficial than a design that doesn't. You could make an argument in that in some circumstances. Are you guys aware of any argument in the IUL space that paying a higher commission to the agent makes a product function better?
Not me.
It just doesn't happen. I was talking to a client the other day and I likened it to going and buying a car. The greater the commission you pay that salesperson, the greater you just paid for that car. But the car itself is going to drive exactly the same. It doesn't affect how the car drives, how much commission you give that agent. In the whole life space, the amount of base and blend, you know, it might make an impact on how much dividend you get credited by the insurance company. But the amount of commission you pay the agent in an IUL does not affect how the index grows. And we get growth in our policy based on how the index grows, nothing else. So when we're trying to design an optimized policy, try to minimize that commission, try to minimize that target premium. Keep that name in mind, target premium. It's one of the most important things you can understand in the IUL space when you want to get a well-designed policy. I want to touch on an outlying scenario. We don't encounter this very much. Most of the designs that we do are using the guideline premium test for the mech test. There are certain circumstances where we might use the alternative cash value accumulation test. That is a separate mech test. It generally involves a higher requirement at risk to the insurance company. Carlo mentioned earlier the net amount at risk. There's a formula. It's based on how old you are. When you want to minimize the amount of insurance that you're paying for in this policy, if you're using the cash value accumulation test, that minimum is higher because the multipliers are higher. So your cost is going to be higher. Normally in a design that we're trying to optimize for cash growth, if we've started it when we're younger, when we get into old age, we're going to try to reduce the amount of death benefit when we stop funding it. And we want to reduce that to the minimum amount because we've grown cash value. We don't want to pay for death benefit anymore. And it just so happens that the death benefit is more expensive in older age. So it works out good that we reduce the expenses, we reduce that death benefit, and we've already grown all this cash value. And now we have this large amount of cash value and the amount of insurance we have to pay for is small. Well, if we use the cash value accumulation test, we have to pay for more death benefit. So generally, we don't use that. In addition, if you have the cash value accumulation test, there's a number of carriers that will not include an overloan protection rider with that policy. The overloan protection rider is like your pull the ripcord in an emergency type of event. If you accidentally or on purpose, you just borrow too much money out of your policy, or you just want to take all the money out of your policy after age 65 or 75, it depends on the carrier, you can trigger that overloan protection rider and essentially just walk away. The insurance company will maintain a minimal death benefit so that your policy doesn't lapse and you're not going to end up with a tax bill. That overloan protection rider is unique. It's fairly unique. There is not very many whole life carriers that offer an overloan protection rider with a whole life policy, but almost all of them offer it with an IUL. The difference being, if you use that cash value accumulation test, it likely does not include an overloan protection rider. But there can be certain circumstances. It's usually for older folks that the cash value accumulation test might be the better choice so that we can have a lower cost of insurance when somebody's older. Case in point, I had a client that was in their late 60s. That might be a situation where we don't want to pay for a whole lot of death benefit throughout the 14, 15 year recovery period where we need a decent amount of time to grow money above and beyond the expenses inside of that policy. The cash value accumulation test has different MEC limits, and we might be able to have a level death benefit that ends up with a lower amount of insurance during that funding period that ends up paying out better at the end. So there's some small scenarios, not very many that I've encountered, but there are some that we might use that cash value accumulation test. There's one more topic. One of the unique features in the IUL is the different loan options that are available. You're not just limited to one type. Let's talk a little bit about that before we wrap this up.
The primary, and I think the main way that I like to use my IUL, is using an indexed loan. So this is what gives us that opportunity for arbitrage. I can borrow at 5%, and you know that's just my particular policy, but I can borrow at 5% in my policy, and I will continue to have the opportunity to participate in the index allocations that I have in my policy. So that's the main way that I like to borrow against my IUL.
And the alternative to a participating index loan?
Well, it depends on the carrier. You can also have the fixed loan option.
Yeah, and the fixed loan option is essentially what's often called the wash loan, where you're going to pay a fixed amount. It might be 2% or 3%. And you're going to get an offsetting credit or something that almost offsets. So you might get a credit that is 2% or 3% that matches or is slightly lower than what your loan rate is. With that type of a loan, you always get some credit. Whereas a participating index loan, you might not get a credit in any given year. So it does carry a little bit of risk to have that participating index loan, with the upside being maybe you earn some arbitrage with the index options. Wow. We covered a lot of ground in today's podcast. What would be the call to action for our listeners this week?
I think I really encourage every single potential client to study and know this IUL compared to whole life, and then know what you want to get into, how much you are comfortable funding, and then know how you're going to use this potential life insurance policy instead of just listen to the salesperson saying, oh, you should do this, 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 and you just do it. Sometimes I notice people are really blind when they sold a life insurance policy. That's your policy. You really need to know the in-depth about how you use it, how you plan to fund it. What's the purpose of this life insurance policy in your whole entire asset portfolio?
I think that I would generally agree. Learn what you can about these products. And if you're thinking about getting a policy for yourself, you'll want to assess what is the purpose of that policy. So I agree with Jing. And in some cases, it might make more sense to start with whole life. In some cases, it might make more sense to start with IUL. Both of these things can be fantastic pieces of an overall asset portfolio. Education is great. You can check out some of our other episodes or some of the content on our own YouTube channels or other YouTube channels to learn about this space.
And I would add that call to action, if a client or if a listener is at all interested in what the IUL has to offer, and you might be hearing some conflicting things about other products that might work, that's a great time to sit down with an insurance agent, maybe multiple insurance agents. You don't have to just choose one. Get some opinions. It's best to try to fit whatever financial product you get. It's best that it fits in with the rest of your overall portfolio. Does it make your overall risk safer among all of your assets? Does it make it riskier? Does it complement what you're trying to do? Is it going to help you meet your goals? Or does it just add an expense? Those are all the things that we should be able to answer when we get a look at what your overall portfolio looks like. And those are the conversations I love to have. So your call to action, reach out to one of us. Let's have a meeting. Let's talk about your overall portfolio and see if one of these might fit for you. And with that, I'm James Barber, your Oregon Cashflow Pro. You can find me on YouTube at Oregon Cashflow Pro. I'm licensed across the country for life insurance and annuities. And I look forward to meeting with you guys.
This is Jane with Tax Exempt Millionaire Club. You can find me on the school community. I'm licensed in multiple states as well. Look forward to talking with you.
And I'm Carlo Vaquera. You can find me at netwellfinance.com or YouTube, SHAPNIN. And I will work with clients for across the country as well.
Thanks for joining us. Be sure to tune in next week. We are going to start the deep dive into infinite banking and all that that entails with regard to high cash value life insurance as we pull back that curtain on all of these products so that you better understand how these things might fit into your portfolio.
See you next time.
Thanks for watching.